We stopped last time talking about the strict complementarity of DNA. What does that refer to? Well, that's part of it. Yes, but that's not, that's a consequence of strict verbatimity. But what is strict verbatimity? I mean, you're almost there, you just didn't give me the detail. What specifically does strict verbatimity say? Complementarity, sorry. Strict verbatimity. That's a rule I use in a drinking game I play. No, it's just in my head. It's strict complementarity. What does that mean? What do I mean by strict complementarity? Yeah, but strict complementarity says that A and T always go together. Adenine and thymine are always together. And guanine and cytosine are always together. That's what it means. And that is why self-replication of DNA can be. That's why, in other words, one strand of a double-stranded DNA can serve as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand, which is what happens in DNA replication. And once we realized that, and once we realized the question is, how does the actual replication occur? And slide 10 shows us three different ways that that could happen. One of these must be true if you're using the rules of strict complementarity. You can see that the three possibilities are the conservative model, the semi-conservative model, and the dispersive model. The conservative model, well, let me say that on all of this, and actually for the rest of the chapter, dark blue indicates the original DNA, old material in other words, and lighter blue represents brand new material, DNA. And the conservative model says that both strands of the original DNA are conserved or saved in one of the cells of the two that split from the original cell. That's why this strand in this first generation is both old material, and a completely new double strand is produced for the other. All right? And then this one would be conserved here and a brand new one produced. This original one is still the same material as two generations ago. That's why it's still dark blue. That's the fully conservative, or just the conservative model. The semi-conservative model, which of course means half conservative, says that just one of the two original strands is conserved, and a brand new strand is then produced to go along with it. So that's why you see this second generation, the first replication, each cell having one old strand and one new strand. That's semi-conservative. The only other possibility, mathematically speaking, is the so-called dispersive model, which is also the most complex. And the most complex things are usually not the things that occur. But it's possible. The dispersive model says that both strands are broken into pieces, basically. New material is created complementarily. And then DNAs are constructed by hooking together old and new material along each of the two strands. So each strand is a mixture of old and new material. All right? Least, like I said, least likely for this to actually have evolved because it's more complicated, but it's still possible. So you have to test these is the point. And that takes, of course, a scientific experiment, which is what slide 11 shows you the results for. And this is another well-designed experiment. They used labeling here, just like we talked about labeling before, but this is not radio labeling. It's not involving radioactivity. Instead, this is using non-radioactive isotopes, but still isotopes. And isotopes, remember, are a different version of the same element, having a different number of neutrons. So normal, run-of-the-mill nitrogen is an N14. N15 is a heavier isotope. And heavier isotopes means heavier because it has that extra neutron, right? Therefore, you can detect heavier stuff by centrifugation. So what they did was allow bacteria to reproduce for a generation using this lighter nitrogen. And then they put the DNA into centrifuge tubes, spun them down. Okay? Then they let it go another generation and spun it down. I'll explain why they had to do two generations here when we look at the results. After the first replication and the first spin, think about what the prediction is for the three different models. If it's the conservative model, that means you should have two bands in your tube because you have totally original material, which would be heavier, and totally new material, which should be lighter, and that should be floating above it. Does that make sense? And you can, the red X means that they did not see that. So right away, they showed that the conservative model is not true. But the semi-conservative model and the dispersive model have the same predictions after one generation. Because in each, even though they work differently, after one generation, you should have just one band in your centrifuge tube. Because in both cases, it's half old material and half new material. And that's why just doing one generation was not enough. They couldn't tell the difference. Okay, all they could say is conservative is out. So they did another replication and noticed that the prediction for the dispersive model would be that you'd still have one band. It would just be higher up because it would be 3/4 new material and 1/4 old material, but still only one band, right? Which the pictures indicate. But the semi-conservative model predicts two bands because you have two cells that have half old and half new and two that have completely new. And that's actually what happened. So this well-designed experiment definitively indicates that what DNA actually replicates by is the semi-conservative model, not the other two. Well, once you have that proven, then the next question, of course, is how does it happen in cells? How does replication actually occur? And that's what we're going to look at now, starting with slide 12. You already are familiar with the fact that there is a dichotomy of cell types, right? Prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells, and they differ in various ways, including their chromosomes. I've already mentioned this. A prokaryotic cell has one chromosome, and it's a circular chromosome, so it forms a loop. There are no ends to it. A eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, has some number of chromosomes, which depends on the species, and those chromosomes are linear, which means each of them has two ends. So that makes it, that also, of course, since chromosomes are DNA, that brings up some differences in how DNA replication occurs, but they're not really very big differences. On the top of slide 12, you see replication happening in a prokaryotic cell. Replication in a eukaryotic cell is on the bottom. I'll get to that next. But notice we have one circular chromosome indicated here, and dark blue, once again, means original material. Now, this is a double-stranded DNA, just like DNA is normally. So that's why you have two circles of blue there. But that's a simplification because it's still, even in a circular chromosome, a double helix. So it would really be twisting all the way around the circle, but it just would be confusing to look at. So for simplicity, they drew it as two circles that do not twist. Anyway, there is no end or beginning to a circular chromosome. Nevertheless, there is one specific place along the circle where replication starts. And that's represented by the two black dots, one on each of the strands. And that place, that specific place where replication begins, has the very descriptive name, origin of replication. We'll look at the molecular details of what happens after this slide, but the origin of replication is where it starts. And like I was talking about before, both of the major functions of DNA, replication, which we're looking at here, or transcription, require reading the code, which itself requires separating the two strands. So that's what has to happen first at the origin of replication. The two strands begin to be separated. And that's easy, of course, because of the hydrogen bonds. That's why it's important for the things holding the two strands together to be weak bonds, which hydrogen bonds are. Well, the separation of the two strands forms a shape called the replication bubble, kind of this football shape right here. And one replication bubble, one football-shaped thing, has two points to it, the points of the football. Those are called replication forks. Now, notice that after the strands are separated to form the replication bubble, brand new DNA is starting to be created. That's what the light blue strands indicate. And the replication bubble just gets bigger and bigger, meaning you unzip the two strands more and more at each of the two ends, at each replication fork, adding new material along the way. And that new material is complementary to the original DNA on each strand. That's where complementarity comes into play as a way for DNA to serve as a template for copying the other strand. Well, that just happens more and more. You can see a photomicrograph of a replication bubble with the two replication forks. It gets bigger and bigger until you get all the way to the other side of the circle, where replication is done, and now you have two double-stranded circular chromosomes genetically identical to each other, and they're both identical to the original double-stranded chromosome. But notice that each of the two resulting chromosomes is semi-conservative. One strand is original material, one strand is new material. That's how it happens in a prokaryote. A eukaryotic cell has multiple chromosomes. Only one is shown here on the bottom for simplicity. But the same thing is happening simultaneously in each of the chromosomes, however many there are in that species.
For that prokaryote, are we looking at a cell, or are we looking at like a chromosome?
That's a chromosome.
This is chromosome?
Yeah, there's no cell shown.
Okay.
And this is a chromosome for a eukaryote. It's one of however many it has that are linear. Now, it's just part of it. That's why it fades off. It's not actually this long. It's much longer, but it's a linear chromosome. And replication bubbles happen are created in eukaryotic cells as well. But think about this. You have a a long linear chromosome that you want to double, you could do it simply by starting in the middle of the length. Have that as your origin of replication. And that's where the bubble would form, right? And the football would get bigger and bigger until you get all the way to both ends, right? That would accomplish what you're trying to do, which is replicate the DNA. But that would take much longer than what actually happens. Instead of there being just one origin of replication for a eukaryotic chromosome, there are multiple spaced apart along the length of the chromosome. That's why you have multiple pairs of black dots here. And simultaneously, each origin of replication opens up to form its own replication bubble. And therefore, they only have to open up and get big enough until they meet the next one that's also opening up. And that will get the job done a lot quicker than if you just have one open up and have to go all the way to the ends. Right? So that really speeds things up. And you can see that here happening in cartoon form. But once all the bubbles open up to the point where all of the original strand gets replicated into a new strand, then you have the same effect as what happened in the prokaryotic example. You have now two double-stranded DNAs that are identical to each other and to the original, and both of them are semi-conservative, half old and half new. That's a quick overview. Now let's, starting in 13, take a look at how this happens molecularly. And there are several different proteins that I'm going to talk about that are important players in the game. All but one of these proteins are acting as enzymes. What we're looking at here, notice it's dark blue, so this is original material, is just one end of one replication bubble. So the replication bubble would continue off the screen here, and it would have a different fork over here. This is just one of the two forks. Like I said, the first thing that has to occur is separation of the two strands. And that involves the first of these proteins I'm going to talk about, which is the green one in the cartoon. That's called helicase. You can tell that's an enzyme just by its name. Helicase breaks the hydrogen bonds at the origin of replication, one of many origins of replication if it's a eukaryotic cell, and separates the two strands from each other at that place. But then it's the helicase, and by the way, another helicase would be operating on the other end of the fork doing the same thing. But the helicase then, after that separating them at the original point, starts moving down and unzipping the fork more and more. All right? Well, that presents a problem. Why are the two DNA strands, before this happened, stuck to each other? Why are they stuck to each other in the first place, in other words? That's right, because they're complementary. And what actually holds them together?
Hydrogen
bonds that match up perfectly because of that complementarity. So if you separate two strands, which helicase does, and then move down, what would happen is that those two strands will go right back together because they're complementary to each other. They'll form the hydrogen bonds again. So to prevent that from happening, a second important protein is working here, and this is the only protein that's not acting as an enzyme. The gray one in the cartoon is called single-strand binding protein. It more or less acts like a little clamp. After helicase separates the two, single-strand binding protein comes along and temporarily binds to the single strand to keep it from going back together with the other strand, keeping them separated, in other words. But both of these are going to move down the length as it gets more and more unzipped. Since the single-strand binding protein, though, keeps them open temporarily, that allows the next important protein to work, which is the pink one in the cartoon, called primase. Now, primase gets its name because its job is to lay down the first new nucleotides, and that short sequence of new nucleotides that gets laid down by primase is called a primer. Now, specifically, it is an RNA primer, meaning the nucleotides that make up this short sequence, shown in red here, are RNA nucleotides. So think about that. We're trying to make a DNA strand, right? It has to be DNA for it to be successful DNA replication. Why in the world then would we use RNA nucleotides instead of DNA? Well, if we didn't have to, we wouldn't, because it would be an unnecessary complication. But it turns out that a cell is not able to lay down DNA nucleotides as the first nucleotides. Lay them down onto nothing, in other words. The only way a cell can add DNA nucleotides is to add them to nucleotides that are already there. RNA nucleotides, on the other hand, can be put down without anything there already. And that's why primers are RNA. They just have to be. Once this short sequence, called the RNA primer, is laid down as new material, then DNA nucleotides can be added one by one to the end of that primer. But that's not primase's job. Primase's job is to put down the primer. The only protein we haven't talked about that's in this cartoon is the blue one at the left, which is called topoisomerase, and there'll be another one at the other fork. This enzyme has an important job because of what would happen if it didn't exist, which you can kind of imagine with a thought experiment. Most rope is more than two strands, right? But just imagine a rope made out of just two strands that's coiled around each other. If you have such a rope, let's say it's connected to the wall, and at this end you try to separate the two strands by pulling them apart, you'll be able to do that fairly easily up to a point, right? The more you pull those apart, the more tightly wound the rest of the rope is going to get. And eventually that overcoiling that's occurring will prevent you from separating them anymore. And the same thing is happening with DNA as it's being unzipped, because this is a double helix. It doesn't look like it in this picture, but it is. So to prevent that overwinding, which would eventually stop further separation of the two strands by helicase, topoisomerase, every now and then, cuts the DNA upstream where it hasn't yet been separated, more or less lets it flop around to relieve the tension, and then seals it back together. That way, helicase can continue to separate the two strands as the bubble gets bigger and bigger. All right, that's everything on this slide. It's not the whole process, though. In 14, we are looking at the elongation of a DNA strand. Once again, dark blue is original material. So this is the template. That's the DNA that's already there. That's what's being read. The light blue is the new material. And you can see that some DNA has already been added. It was added one nucleotide at a time, but now we're adding a new nucleotide. All right, now speaking of nucleotides, what does nucleotide tell you? What are the components of a nucleotide? What is it? You already said phosphate.
Oh, sugar.
Yes. How many of each? Well, I'm talking about one nucleotide. How many of each of those components are there? Well, you don't know from the word nucleotide. Yes, there's one nitrogenous base, one sugar, and at least one phosphate. That's why nucleotide is kind of an ambiguous word. Back when we were talking about ATP, which is a nucleotide, by the way, that's why I said ATP. That's why I said nucleotide is not really a good way to describe ATP because of that ambiguity. Instead, it's better to call ATP a nucleoside triphosphate, right? What's the difference between a nucleoside and a nucleotide? In which of the two? Right, a nucleoside is just the nitrogenous base and the sugar. So if you do have phosphates, you can call it a nucleoside monophosphate if there's just one, a nucleoside diphosphate if there are two phosphates, or a nucleoside triphosphate. Those are non-ambiguous words because they tell you how many phosphates are there, right? Okay, now notice what's coming in on the bottom here as the new monomer to be added to the growing polymer. It's a nucleoside triphosphate. Nitrogenous base, thiamine in this case, because it matches up with adenine that is being read. The pentose sugar, which, it, since we're building DNA, is deoxyribose. And three phosphates, a nucleoside triphosphate. Yes, it is a nucleotide, but nucleoside triphosphate tells you specifically what kind of nucleotide it is. However, this thing is, once it gets incorporated into the DNA strand that's growing, is not going to be a 3-phosphate nucleotide. It's not going to be a nucleoside triphosphate. It's going to be a nucleoside monophosphate, like all the other ones that are already in there. Does that make sense? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying here? Why then would you bring in a nucleoside triphosphate when what you really need is a nucleoside monophosphate as a monomer?
Because you can take off the phosphates?
Well, you can, but if you didn't have those phosphates to begin with, two of them, if you just had one, if you had a nucleoside monophosphate, that's what needs to be in the final product. Why not just bring it in as a nucleoside monophosphate? What's that? Right, they are. But nucleoside monophosphate is what's going to be in the final product. So why not use what's going to be in the final product? Well, think about ATP, which is also a nucleotide, except it's made out of an RNA. What do you know about ATP? Right. And how would you describe the building of a DNA molecule? Endergonic, yes. You're building a polymer. That's going to be an expensive process, right? So why bring the new nucleotide in as a nucleoside triphosphate? To provide the energy. When you cleave those two extra phosphates off, which are not going to be part of the strand, that releases energy that can be used to allow you to attach this next monomer to the growing strand, which is endergonic, as far as energy is concerned. All right? That's why. And very importantly, this can happen. The addition of a new nucleotide to a growing strand can happen only at the 3' end of the growing strand. You can't add a new nucleotide at the other end, the 5' end. You can only add it to the 3' end. Keep that in mind. And that's why you see it happening at the 3' end. Well, it shouldn't surprise you at this point that this reaction, the addition of a new nucleotide to a growing strand, is catalyzed. Effectively, all reactions in a cell are catalyzed, right? So that involves another protein, this time acting as an enzyme, shown in orange. DNA polymerase. Now, even if that were not named DNA polymerase, which obviously indicates it's an enzyme, you should know that it's an enzyme. Why? I said, even if its name didn't have the ASE. How else is it obvious that this is an enzyme?
The title of the arrow?
Right. It is not on either end of the arrow. So it's not a reactant or a product. It's above the arrow or below it. You could do it either way, but that indicates it's an enzyme. Now, DNA polymerase is named for the fact that its job is to polymerize, which means to form a polymer, make it longer by adding one more nucleotide to the 3' end of the growing strand. All right? Another important thing beyond this fact that you can add only to the 3' end is that the new strand that's being built, which is actually a copy of the other original strand, right? The one that has been removed. That new strand that's being built has to be anti-parallel to the original strand. So that's why this 3' end of the new strand is matched up with the 5' end of the original strand. That's anti-parallel. Keep that in mind, too. It'll make the next couple slides easier to understand. Now, DNA polymerase uses the energy of dephosphorylation of the incoming nucleoside triphosphate. Not the way we usually do with ATP, though, which is to split off one phosphate, right, to make ADP. Instead, two of the 3 phosphates are stripped off in one shot. And that leaves just one, which is what it needs to be a member of the growing strand, right? But that forms 2 phosphates that are no longer part of a carbon skeleton, and that's why they're inorganic, but they're still connected to each other. 2 inorganic phosphates hooked together are called pyrophosphate. That doesn't last very long, though, because it will pretty quickly separate into just 2 individual inorganic phosphates and become part of the phosphate pool that's always there. All right? That's DNA polymerase's job to do this. But DNA polymerase is actually a category. There's not just one version of DNA polymerase. You can't see that detail here, but this specific version of DNA polymerase doing the job of elongating the growing DNA strand is called DNA polymerase 3, Roman numeral 3. All right, let's go to 15 now. The top box shows you one replication bubble with its 2 replication forks. Now, the new material in light blue is being added down based on complementarity rules to match up with the original dark blue material. Notice, though, that there are 2 categories of strands being produced. There are the so-called leading strands, which are diagonally situated within the bubble, and there are 2 so-called lagging strands being built at the same time. Here's where it is important to understand what I was saying in the previous slide, namely that it's possible only to add a new DNA nucleotide to the 3' end, not to the 5' end of the growing strand. And that new strand has to be anti-parallel to the original strand that's being read. Okay, so this presents a problem. The leading strand doesn't have that problem. Now look at the detail in the middle here, because here you can see where the what the directionality of the original strands are. The original DNA, the top strand of the original DNA, notice is 5 prime at the left. The other end would be 3 prime, of course. Therefore, the new material, the new strand, the light blue strand, this really should be light blue right here, this little section, has to be anti-parallel to that. That's why you see this one 5 prime on this end. This end would be 3 prime. All right? And remember I said that new nucleotides can be added only to the 3 prime end of the growing strand. So you can't add them on this side of the primer. You have to add them on this side of the primer. And then it's just no longer primer once you're adding DNA. It's just longer and longer DNA strand. But the point here is that as helicase opens this fork up more and more, unzips the two original strands, this leading strand is in the perfect orientation with its 3 prime end facing the fork, because as the fork opens up, it'll just allow more and more DNA to be added to the 3 prime end. It's growing, in other words, in the leading strand is growing in the same direction that the fork is opening up. And that's why it's called the leading strand, by the way. It's, since it's easier for that to happen, it is produced more quickly. Lagging strand takes a little longer. So there is no problem for the leading strand or the other leading strand corresponding on the other template strand at the other end of the fork, which is off screen here. The lagging strand, on the other hand, does have a problem. So the bottom strand here, notice, is 3 prime on the left, 5 prime on the right. When you build a new strand, it's going to have to be 3 prime on the right, 5 prime on the left. You still, though, have to grow the thing in the 3 prime direction, which is now opposite of the direction the fork is being opened up. Do you see what I'm saying there? Because this confuses a lot of people, so tell me. Okay, when I open up this fork, the new strand that's being built here would be 3 prime on the right end. But I'm opening the fork up toward the left, which is behind the direction that it has to grow in.
Yes.
Just opposite of the leading strand. I have to grow it toward the right, though. So I can't just keep adding nucleotides as it opens up, because it's opening up in the wrong direction. I therefore have to put down a primer, grow it this way, let the fork open up, put down another primer, and then grow it this way until I run into the previous primer, and so on. In other words, the lagging strand has to be made piecewise, one little piece at a time, each requiring its own primer that is laid down as soon as the fork opens up enough.
Once it's opening, you have the primer coming along with it.
Right, and a gap, and then another fragment. You add DNA until you run into the previous one that was laid down to fill in that hole, and then you wait till it opens up some more and make another fragment. It's all one piece continuously being made. So these fragments that need to be produced for the lagging strand are called Okazaki fragments. An eponym doesn't tell you anything about them, of course, but named after a dead scientist. All right, let's also, though, look at what the new players in the game are that I haven't mentioned yet. Well, actually, we don't see new players in the game, but let's review what's happening here. The leading strand only requires one primer to be laid down. That, of course, was laid down by primase, which is not shown here. Once the primer is laid down, DNA polymerase 3, which is the orange thing, is laying down one new nucleotide at a time at the 3 prime end, which for the leading strand is in the same direction it's opening up. So it just keeps getting longer and longer as the bubble opens. The same thing is happening for the Okazaki fragments. You just don't see that on this. The green one is helicase. It's unzipping it more and more as it goes along, and the gray ones are the single strand binding proteins holding them together long enough, holding them apart long enough for DNA polymerase 3 to do its job. Okay, 16 is just a close up of that top part of the previous slide, but now you see numbering to the Okazaki fragments. Right? One was produced before 2. One was produced before the fork opened up enough to have room for 2 to be built. But notice they are growing in the direction opposite the direction of the opening of the fork. And the same thing's happening diagonally on the other end of the replication bubble. This is opening up toward the right, but the lagging strand has to be built toward the left because that's where the 3 prime is on that side. Okay, so one would be produced, then 2, then 3, then another one as soon as it opens up more and more. Those are the Okazaki fragments that together make up the lagging strand. And it's called that because it takes a little longer for that to happen, so it lags behind the leading strand. 17 now. Well, at the top you have primase laying down a primer, because you have to start with RNA, like I said. You can't put DNA down onto nothing. Then DNA polymerase 3 comes along and elongates that with DNA nucleotides. Here you have, this is happening in the lagging strand, as you see, because a previous primer had already been laid down. So you only have to extend this new primer up to the point where you run into the previous primer. That fills in all the gaps, so you have all the nucleotides in place. Okay, then you open it up even more. The fork isn't shown, but it would be opening up to the left. And a new primer is put down, and you elongate that with DNA until you run into the previous fragment, and so on. Okay, so no new information there, really, but until we get down to the yellow thing. When all of the DNA nucleotides have been added, meaning there aren't any holes, then you're still not done for a couple reasons. One is that when the holes are filled, you have the problem of the primers. One primer per leading strand and several primers for the lagging strand. However many primers there are, each primer is made up of RNA, right? That cannot be allowed to stay in the final product. So that's one problem. Just because you have all the nucleotides in place doesn't mean they're all the correct nucleotides. Those RNA nucleotides have to be removed and replaced with the appropriate versions of DNA nucleotides. And that requires its own specialist enzyme, the one shown in yellow here, which is another version of DNA polymerase. This is DNA polymerase 1. DNA polymerase 1 removes the RNA nucleotides of the primers, and by then it has something it can add DNA to. That's why it can remove the RNA. And it adds the appropriate DNA nucleotides to fill them up. The job is still not complete, though, because DNA polymerase 1 is not able to form that final phosphodiester bond. Well, actually, down here. Notice this little nick? It can't make the phosphodiester bond between the sugar and the phosphate of this last one. So that requires its own enzyme to do that job. That's the teal-colored one on the bottom. And that's called ligase, or DNA ligase. Now notice that ligase gets its name from the fact that it ligates. It ties together. Same thing ligands are named for. To ligate means to tie together the fragments, however many there are. And once that's done, then you do have a complete DNA produced that's a new strand that's complementary to the original strand. And the same exact thing, meanwhile, had happened with the other original strand, with the same proteins working. So overall, you have 2 semi-conservative copies of DNA at the end. DNA replication. Yeah.
Okay, so for the lagging strands, primase is going to like come in and do its thing, and then what comes between those points is the Okazaki fragments?
The Okazaki fragments are each little piece of the lagging strand. Each fragment contains one primer and a little section of DNA nucleotides. So this is one Okazaki fragment. This is another. Yes. And when I said that all the nucleotides are in place, I mean there aren't any holes left like this where there's no nucleotides. But there still is the problem that some of those nucleotides are RNA, all of the primers, in other words. And that's where DNA polymerase 1 comes into play. And then DNA ligase sews them all together end to end. All right, 18 is really just a review, but it shows you all the players. Primase, well, first, helicase unzips. It creates the bubble to begin with and then unzips at each fork. Single-strand binding proteins clamp the two strands so that they don't go back together right away. That allows primase to come along, lay down the RNA primers, giving something to work with so that DNA polymerase 3 can then add DNA nucleotides to those strands, making them longer. There's only one primer required for each leading strand, but there's a primer for each of the Okazaki fragments for the lagging strand. Once all the holes are filled, then DNA polymerase 1 comes along and takes out the RNA nucleotides and replaces them with the corresponding version of DNA nucleotides. And then DNA ligase comes along and sews them all together. All right, now, 19 is not really so much about replication. This is about error checking. Cells have proofreading capability. Even without the proofreading capability, the incidence of error is really impressively low. If we compare it to things like industrial processors or something, the factory making something or whatever. You know, if a factory was told it could have an error rate of 1 in 1,000,000, it would jump at the chance, right? Because there's a lot more errors than that made in real factories. 1,000,000 is a pretty big number. But remember how big nucleic acids are. Each individual chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. So even if you had an error rate of only 1 in 1,000,000, which is really impressive, that means you would still have multiple errors in each chromosome. Right? So And errors do occur, but not only is the error rate low to begin with, meaning that all of this mechanism works pretty flawlessly most of the time, but even when there is an error, cells are able to recognize the errors and fix them. That's what the proofreading is. So the effective error rate is even lower. We can see just one part of this proofreading, how it works, in slide 19. Now, this little section of DNA shown here has been damaged. Notice the little bulge in the top strand. And notice the black line between the two nucleotides, or the two nitrogenous bases. Those are two nitrogenous bases that are adjacent to each other on the same strand, right? Keep in mind that they're not supposed to be interacting with each other. Nitrogenous bases on the same strand are just hanging off of the backbone. They're not connected to each other. They don't hold the thing together. The sugar phosphate backbone holds it together. But, especially when you have two T's next to each other, and the sequence can be anything, remember, so it can be two T's next to each other, that makes it chemically fairly possible for those two thymines to form a covalent bond between them, called a thymine-thymine dimer. That's exactly what that little horizontal black line indicates. And this happens, for instance, by exposure to ultraviolet radiation from sunlight. This is why sunlight causes cancer. Cancer is a genetic disorder. Something happens to the DNA that causes loss of control of the cell cycle. This is one way it can happen. But anyway, this is an error. And cells have things called nucleases. That's really a category, not a specific enzyme. Nucleases work on nucleic acids to recognize a problematic section, and then they undergo what is called excision repair. Excision is the noun of excise, which means to cut out. So what the nuclease does is, after it recognizes this is a problematic sequence, it snips both ends of that sequence so it can just remove that whole sequence. And that's removal of information, of course, but it's not a problem because you still have the other strand to read, which means you can put back new versions of exactly the correct nucleotide simply by reading the complementary other strand. But that requires, that nuclease doesn't do that, it just removes it. Then DNA polymerase 1, the same one that worked before to remove the primers, is able to come along and fill in with the correct DNA nucleotides, but just like before, it can't make that final phosphodiester bond, so you also have to have DNA ligase come along to sew it to the others.
So once it has a problem, is it permanently damaged? Is that why they couldn't just give the covalent bond between them? Would they always end up interconnecting?
Well, it can happen again. No, the cell doesn't have a mechanism to just break the covalent bond. You have to cut it out and start over. But when you start over, you're going to add two thymines again, right? Because that's appropriate. Those thymines are supposed to be there. And therefore, if sunlight strikes it again, it could happen again. It's just that it's being fixed here. Now, some of these errors do not get repaired. And that's why eventually DNA does get damaged more and more as we age. But this is how things go when it actually successfully notices the problems and undergoes proofreading. We're on 20 now, and 20 has to do with a problem that prokaryotic cells do not have. This is only a problem for eukaryotic cells, and this has to do with the difference that I was talking about. A prokaryotic cell has a circular chromosome. A circular chromosome doesn't have any ends. This is a problem that occurs only for chromosomes that have ends. In other words, linear chromosomes that are only in eukaryotic chromosomes. The very ends of a linear chromosome are called telomeres. Telo meaning far. The reason it's a problem, well, let's look at what's happening here. This dark blue is the original DNA strand. So this is the 3' end of it. There's no other DNA past that. That's the end of the chromosome. It's no problem to lay down an RNA primer on that, because RNA can be added down to nothing, right? It doesn't have to be built on anything. That's why you need primers to begin with. So the primer's put down, no problem. And once you have the primer, then you can add DNA nucleotides to it, no problem, just like we were talking about. And also, it's no problem then for DNA polymerase 1 to come along and remove the primer. But then you get to a problem, because since there's no other fragment to the left, which there would be for the rest of the chromosome, then when DNA polymerase 1 comes along and removes the RNA, it can't add the DNA to replace it because there's nothing here to add to. Do you see what I'm saying there? It would be trying to put down DNA onto nothing, and it can't do that. So all it can do is remove the RNA and leave nothing there. which means that each generation in a eukaryotic cell, each cell cycle, a chromosome gets a little bit shorter. Since you can't add the DNA all the way to the end. Well, this is a huge problem, or it could be a huge problem. We haven't talked much about genes yet, we will, but genes are really just shorter sequences of DNA within the overall very long sequence that is the chromosome. And so the whole thing is a sequence, but there are genes that are sequences, and then there are sequences between genes, and then another gene, and so on. And genes are really important because they are where the codes mean something. They stand for how to build an RNA molecule. All right? Well, if this problem with telomeres means that the DNA gets shorter each generation, then eventually you're going to be eating into genes themselves, right? By making the DNA shorter. This sequence right here might not be a problem to lose because it might not be in a gene. Eventually, though, somewhere you're going to have a gene, and if it gets shorter and shorter each generation, you're going to eat into the gene. This is analogous to film, although it's no longer a current analogy because movies nowadays are digital, so they don't have film and projectors at most places. But when you use film to project, you have reels of it, of course, right? You have to load those into the projector. The movie is made up of individual frames, of course, and those frames are kind of like genes. In an overall long strip, the overall movie, film is like the entire chromosome, where the individual frames of the movie are like genes. And if you have a very popular movie, it gets shown a lot of times. Well, loading the film into the projector messes it up because doing it too many times, it gets worn out. But that's no problem, though, because film reels come with long leaders, as they're called, giving you room to snip off a little piece to give you a fresh edge to load into the projector. That's no problem. You can do that a certain number of times. It makes the film a little shorter, but you still have, the first frame isn't until over here, so you're not eating into the movie. But if you do that enough times, eventually you will eat into the movie, right? That would be like eating into the genes if this gets shorter and shorter. And it will, as long as cell cycles keep going on. What this means is that we would be doomed. We would have gone extinct because the DNA would have gotten too short eventually. Well, obviously that didn't happen. We exist. So there is a way around this that eukaryotic cells have evolved. And this is helped by an enzyme that's named for telomeres. The enzyme itself is called telomerase. Telomerase is a eukaryotic enzyme whose job it is to put down just a dummy sequence at the end of a chromosome that doesn't code for anything. It's basically just a fresh leader, so that you can then eat into that without damaging anything. Yeah?
DNA polymerase 1
takes care of removing RNA and adding DNA in its place. But that's the problem. At the very end, look at it right here. This is not the end. When DNA polymerase 1 comes along here and removes that RNA, it can add the DNA because this piece it can add to. But over here, when it removes the RNA primer, there's nothing here to add to, and you can't add DNA onto nothing. So it has to just leave it empty.
Okay.
But it is DNA polymerase 1 doing that job of removal of the primer.
But again, specifically, it's polymerase?
Yes, it just adds a new leader, basically, so that you can get away from this problem that eukaryotes have. The final two slides in this chapter are really one figure in the book, just one wide figure. So the right edge of 21 goes into the left edge of 22. But also, as you scan from left to right on this overall two-slide figure, you're getting farther and farther out. You're zooming out. You're really zoomed in here looking at just the DNA itself originally. But what's portrayed in this figure is the organization of DNA in a cell. And it's pretty amazing that we're able to pack in as much DNA as we can, because every cell in your body, every living cell in your body except for your red blood cells, has DNA in it, has a full copy of DNA. And the DNA just in one cell, one of your cells, which is the genome, if you were to stretch that out, it would be more than a meter long. That needs to get packed into a cell that is invisibly small. And it's even more impressive than that, because it's not just in the entire cell, right? It's in a nucleus of a cell, which is even smaller than the cell, which is already invisible. Plus, during the S phase and beyond, there's actually twice that much DNA in there that's packed into that nucleus somehow. So that takes a lot of careful packing, which is what this figure is showing you. And we've talked about chromatin already. Chromatin is the mixture of DNA plus proteins, and we see here that the specific proteins are called histones, the purple things. Each histone kind of looks like a human sperm. It has a globular head and a tail, but it's just a protein. Now, when you get eight of these identical histones together, arranged like you see here with their heads together and their tails radiating outwardly, you produce what, in effect, is a hose reel. Those tails make it a nice reel. And you can wrap some of the length of the DNA some number of times around that hose reel. And what you that then shortens the length of the DNA, of course. And keeps it organized. But the combination of all of those eight histones, plus however much DNA wraps around it in that reel, is called a nucleosome. And that alone makes it a lot more compact. There's many, many nucleosomes. If that were the only thing happening, then it would look like beads on a string, because each nucleosome would be a bead, and then you have DNA that's not wound occurring between each of them, which is the string part. That's not the only thing happening, though. Once you have the nucleosomes produced, then you start bunching together the nucleosomes themselves. That's what's happening on the right edge here, making it a lot more compact. And as we continue rightward into slide 22, you can see that much more compact strand. Now, it's not that it's getting smaller. We're zooming out as we go to the right. Then that already compact strand is looped many, many times to make an even wider piece that is how a chromosome is constructed. Remember, chromosome, we don't use that word unless it's really compacted. So this degree of compactness doesn't exist except when you actually see visible chromosomes. It's looser before that. And it needs to be loose for most of the cell cycle, because it still needs to be read as a code for the purpose of transcription. Okay, that's that chapter.